Hello, this is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted today to be here with Tara Deport, who's going to tell us who she is, what she does, and how she makes trouble.
So I've been an artist and an environmentalist pretty much my entire life, and my current incarnation of this work is I'm both the founder of an NGO based in New York City called the Human Impacts Institute, who really inspires people to find a way to take social issues and environmental issues and connect them to make action.
I've heard you talk about this a little bit, and so one of the things you're particularly interested in, is sort of a nub, is how to get scientists embedded in that kind of communication environment and public engagement environment. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell us about the trouble you have with scientists?
Well, it's interesting because just personally, I started with a very scientific background. So I see myself and both myself and our organization as often the types of people and groups that can communicate and can be a part of many different specialist circles. So for instance, I can go into a super climate science, meeting and understand what they're talking about and be able to read data about ice cores and things like that, but also can go into the United Nations and see, understand the policy speak. And I think one of the things, to come back to your question, that we see a lot is, particularly with specialists in any field, is you rightly so have to get very entrenched in the knowledge of that field and your expertise, that it becomes hard to communicate outside of it, and it becomes hard to translate particularly very technical information like science, and particularly climate science, to people outside of your field.
So one of the things I mentioned to you was that I'm writing a text with a French physicist, Jean-Marc Levy-Leblanc, at the moment. There are a few issues that he's brought up that I just wanted to raise. One is how scientists understand the boundaries of their scientific expertise when that expertise is transposed into societal issues. And as we were chatting, a climate scientist and a geologist, they may both be experts, but they don't have maybe applicable expertise necessarily to these public issues. And so, tied to that is also this whole issue of how you communicate the uncertainty in the things you're talking about, which obviously when you close the door and the scientists are arguing among themselves is a big topic. But often when you get into the public domain, somehow certainty is what's communicated. So you want to react to those two things? The boundaries of scientific expertise and communicating uncertainty.
Sure. I'm going to throw you a little bit of a loop or a turn, because I think one of the things, particularly when we're talking about the type of work I do, which is really to inspire people to take action, is I think it's often good, no matter who we're talking with or working with, is to see what our end goal is. So to say, is it for us to get off of fossil fuels, or is it more, to create more urban green spaces, or whatever the goal is, small or big, and then work backwards with the community that you're addressing to see what's the, way to get from point A to B, from where we are right now to the end goal.
And so part of that is translating these kind of big, large abstract issues into local relevancy, I guess, and how it affects an individual person's life or livelihood or environment.
Yeah, and I think part of it is also something we were talking about earlier, which is to try to figure out what information is actually needed. And, particularly when it comes to scientific information, coming back to your original question, that's often, we're talking about expertise again, and we're talking about very complicated things that you or I wouldn't necessarily understand if given a 1-minute soundbite. And so how to decide when science is applicable to the actions that we want, and when communication of that science is really important, I think is a really key step that we're often missing. And another one is that we need to know who we're talking to. It's kind of, to me, I look at it a bit as kind of the basic market research, is you don't develop a campaign we can even use the sales version of it. You don't just develop one campaign to sell to anybody. You have to know who you're talking to to get them.
That distinction is intriguing to me. I mean, one of the things I've been tracking recently is this move in the citizen science movement to what they call collaborative science. And so, you know, rather than viewing the public as cheap labor and somehow they don't really get it, but they're going to help us, to actually saying we have a shared interest in solving something. In this case, it's how we change human behavior because of the climate change predictions. And there, how you get into a collaborative mode with your audience and not just a communication mode. I don't know if that resonates.
Definitely. And that also comes back a little bit to your question of boundaries of knowledge, and that, you know, if we've been doing the same thing for a long time, no matter whether it is relating to astrophysics or relating to just our daily routines, we get entrenched in our habits and what we think we know and what we've learned from experience, which are all important. You know, it's part of the human process. But that also can stifle creativity and new thinking. So I think these types of collaborations where you work with people outside of your expertise, or you open up to other people having big, crazy ideas about how to look at water quality or how to, you know, address environmental justice in a community or whatever it might be, opens up that, you know, those beautiful mistakes or those beautiful insights. And that's something that really excites me about our work with bringing artists and scientists and policymakers together.
Okay, so let me just pick on that. So as you said, you work as an artist. The way that you've chosen to enter into these issues and the public understanding is through the creation of artwork. Maybe you could just mention a couple of examples of specific ways that you've done that.
Sure. And just to also be clear is that I actually kind of toggle both personally and also with our organization. We toggle back and forth between using the arts to communicate and inspire people and then using the more qualitative and quantitative, actually, you know, harder data and science to connect people to action. So, you know, I think going back and forth between the two is important. And, you know, one example that excites me that we just launched recently is our program called Human Impact Stories. And the idea is we've started with really looking at climate change and looking at very diverse people who are taking action in different ways on climate. And instead of you know, resubmitting their research papers or, you know, making infographics, which can be amazing, we're trying to get their personal side of their story, to humanize science and scientists, to show their personal doubts or fears or big wins, and to connect people with more of an emotional connection with these big ideas.
Okay, that allows me to tie to an earlier discussion we had. Both of us have worked on both sides of the Atlantic and have experience in both those cultural contexts. So obviously when you start bringing these issues home to people's individual existence, clearly societal, social environment they're in, which is clearly different in the United States and France. So what are some of the differences that you'd sort of highlight there, or attitudinal differences or behavioral differences?
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, in both places we have to generalize country, but I'm gonna, there's some very strong ones that have really excited me to work on these transatlantic partnerships. And one is, particularly when we look at environmental issues and addressing environmental issues, in the U.S., we tend to have a culture of individualism, you know, the American I can do it spirit. And we also have a relatively poor track record, particularly in recent times, of federal regulation around environmental issues. You know, some people would disagree with me on that, but compared to the European Union, we have relatively few regulations, you know, from top government. And most Americans, a lot of Americans don't want that. Some do.
The principle of precaution is unknown in the States.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Europe, which
as someone who's who's very much a proponent of it, that can be frustrating. But we often see the opposite in Europe, where there's a long culture in many countries here of Well, that's the government's responsibility, is to take care of the public domain, which often the environment is seen as that, where that's not up to us as individuals. The government will take care of it, which may or may not be the case. So we're seeing, even though, of course, we see a groundswell of amazing local initiatives, we see a lot more innovative policy happening in Europe, particularly on a more countrywide scale. And then we see a lot of grassroots movements building, you know, and city type of policy and even regional policy that's happening despite what's happening at the federal government. So there's, I think, a lot to be learned there from each side.
We've just got a couple of minutes left on this first podcast. I can't help but, you know, obviously we're enjoying talking to each other. And one of the things we clearly share is a fundamental optimism about social engagement and social action. Do you think you're making a difference?
I was just talking with my mom about this yesterday. You know, it's like, depending on the minute, I'm an optimist and a pessimist at the same time. I think our team and me as an individual are making a difference. Is it the difference that I'd like to see? No, we're not there yet. But, you know, I'm in it for the long haul. And I think the type, particularly working in something like climate change, when we're talking about so many different systems, social and environmental, you have to keep some of that optimism, because otherwise it becomes, yeah, you know, the paralysis.
Thing,
you know,
the thing late at night that kind of frightens me is, if you look at the last 50,000 years of human societies, when culture had to change because of changing conditions, disease, earthquakes, whatever, people moved. And so migration was the... And there, if the climate is changing slowly enough over 1,000 years, people can kind of move and get themselves reorganized. But here, we're living with problems that have 10-year, 50-year timescales, and I think it's unprecedented for human beings to actually modify the way they live. The best you can do is hope your great-grandchildren will live differently.
Yeah, and you know, from my own observations and just understandings of self, I think we tend to be very reactive, yeah, as a species, and we also don't, long-term thinking is not our specialty, so it becomes... and it becomes scary because we also with.
Although I'm just working with my 20-year-old children who are setting up their first savings accounts.
Oh my goodness! Wow, do they know what that means?
Well, you know, and
not
when
yet.
You know, and I've explained that when you do that when you're 22, there's a lot more money when you're 80 than if you just delay the investing in your savings account.
Goodness. So, well, that's a whole other conversation, but
okay,
relevant.
Tara, we're going to have to wrap up this first podcast, but it's triggered in my mind a number of follow-up questions, particularly in relation to the projects you're going to be doing here at IMRA in Marseille, the Mediterranean Institute of Advanced Studies. So thank you, and on to the next podcast. So if you're listening, please listen to the next one. Thank you.
Thank you.